Welcome to the Mystery Alive podcast, brought to you by Mind Over Mystery. Each week, our experts, Lars and David, and their guests will bring you intriguing perspectives on real cases and real scenarios. This informal discussion by the Mystery Masters comes from the living room, not the classroom or the boardroom. They chat candidly and tell you how they really feel about some of the most challenging cases ever to stump lovers of mystery.
Oh, well, my heavens, we're back here this evening in Mind Over Mystery Land. And I'm David.
And I'm Lars.
And we're here to talk to you about an interesting mystery of some genre every week. And what have we decided to talk about this week, Lars?
We're going to talk about Carlos Castaneda. And it's a real sad thing for me.
You mean the Carlos Castaneda, the spiritual phenomenon of the 1960s and 70s?
That's exactly who I mean.
And it's sad. We've got a bite on that one. Why is it sad
for you? Because I feel like I was duped. I found out he was I thought he was amazing. I thought all the stuff that he was telling us was so true and that it actually happened. And it changed my life completely. And then I find out he turned out to be a con man.
A con man. You know, on the website, I think, use the phrase, Carlos Castaneda, mystic icon to a generation, or a charlatan. And yet it occurs to me, and you and I teamed up on writing that, but it occurs to me that, can't you be both? And that's what a lot of people are going to say. What's the difference? That's what we're here to analyze. That's what we're here to figure out about the human psyche.
That's what's interesting to me, because I don't want him to be a con man, but then again, he did so many good things by helping me improve my life by looking outward instead of, I looked inward and outward. So again, I love the way you say that.
Now, to begin, we should probably remind folks who aren't old enough to remember the Castaneda phenomenon, and it was a phenomenon.
It was.
Exactly what this was all about. A young fellow who was an anthropology student, UCLA, back in the day, in the 1950s, says he discovered a sorcerer of the Yaqui tribe in Sonora, Mexico, by some felicitous set of events. And he began being this man's apprentice, which opened up a whole new world of knowledge for him. And he says he took copious notes, and from those notes wrote his anthropology doctoral thesis, and only later discovered that these notes were so meaningful to the public that they became best-selling books. That's the story, that he rose from anthropology student to famous spiritual leader. And he did, when those books became popular, they sold millions.
Millions.
And millions. And millions.
Yeah, I discovered him around 1971, about 2 years after his first book.
And you and I talked about this, how it would have been typical, let's say, in the 70s to go to someone's home and there you might see their record collection, there might be a hash pipe or something from those psychedelic days, whatever,
right?
Paraphernalia of the culture or the counterculture.
And it always included one of his books, always.
A paperback of Castaneda's, of which he wrote 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 finally were out there. There'd always be a Castaneda book sitting around.
And it was very well thumbed, I may add. And you'd read from it and you'd be like, check this out. Oh my goodness, did you hear this? And you're like, yes, I read that. So it was a topic of conversation. It was a topic of inspiration. It made a lot of us decide, okay, we're going to do greater things than we probably are meant to be doing.
He was a primary spiritual guide of the 60s and 70s and beyond, but that was really the heyday of his work, the great impact of his work. And can we describe to people in a few words what essentially his message was after all this study with supposedly the sorcerers, the seers of the Yaqui culture?
Well, most of it involved taking copious amounts of mushrooms and weed and
peyote and the whole bit,
yeah, everything. So again, I think that's why it appealed to me and my ilk. So,
but he kept moving on, didn't he? Because I was just reading, I was going Journey to Ixalan, went back to that book, and he says, well, yeah, for the first few years of doing this, I thought it was all hallucinogens. And then I started to realize that's part of the picture, But that's not really what the sorcerer's apprentice should be learning. I finally got it through my head that's you don't really need all that stuff.
Exactly. And again, that's what made us go, wow, he really does know what's going on. Because that's kind of the thing we all went through. We all did a few drugs, we hung out with rich people, and then we kind of moved on and we expanded our horizons. And it was, like I said, it was life-changing for me and so many of my friends.
Many people expressed an interest. Let me just say, for instance, in Journey to Ixalan, in the early pages, you'll encounter the Don Matus.
Yes.
Saying, well, no, there's a totally different way if someone's having disciplinary problems. You have a friend who has a child who's out of control. Don't try to discipline him yourself. Hire a thug. And this is now serious. We're not making this up. You can go back to the text. Hire a thug to wait in the bushes until you walk by with your child. And as your child says something sassy or commits an infraction, have the thug jump out, beat the holy crap out of your child as a way of getting your child's attention. And if you do this two or three or four or five times, your kid will finally be in a different reality. You will have stopped the world, the bad flow of the world for him, and you will have made him think without being in confrontation with him directly. And in one sense, I think, yeah, that's a creative way to look at it. And in another, I think, are you serious?
My first thought is, oh my God, I think that's the only book my dad ever read.
And the other thing that was interesting in those early pages is Don Matus is saying, you really need to understand that you have no personal history. That's an illusion. That's something that doesn't really exist. You go beyond that. You're going to a separate reality, a better reality, or a finer reality. You have no history. And there may be, my thought was, you know, there may be a lot of wisdom in that. We're so hung up on the worldly things. What happened to me 5 years ago? Do I have to explain it to somebody? And in another sense, the cynic in me is saying, yeah, that's one more example of giving a message that plays well to disturb people, which is kind of most of us.
We have
some agony going on.
Right.
And this is one more thing that gives people permission to say, I don't need to worry about the past. Man, I'm on a different reality. I don't need to worry about the past. I don't need to explain myself to anybody. I'm following the path that I'm following, seeking the reality that I'm following. Don't bore me with this other trivial stuff.
Exactly. Those petty felonies.
Yeah, you know, so it's kind of the lens that you look at it through.
Right.
Mystic icon to a generation or a charlatan, and could you not be both? And what's the difference? I mean, that's kind of what we're exploring. We're exploring the life of Castaneda in our talk tonight, and I think we're going to have to probably have a follow-up, at least one follow-up.
Oh, I think we are, because there's so much to this. Because when we first started talking about it, I said, what to you is the mystery? What's the mystery that we're trying to talk about tonight?
I mean, to me, it's two or threefold. I guess we've got to pick a place to start. It's what actually happened in his life. Silly me, I'm hung up as a journalist on facts and truth and
right.
things like that. But it's also the bigger question of who becomes a spiritual leader, a spiritual seer. And what is it about that person's psychology, spirituality, that helps them rise above the rest? And then secondly, what is it gets the rest of us with our mouths hanging open, just adoring and following these people? Those are the questions that intrigue me.
I think you're right. Because one of the things that I've talked about last week, I said, it is funny how we think the people in the past knew the answers. We go, oh yeah, the Incas, they knew. Oh, the Mayans, totally, they absolutely knew. And those Egyptians, obviously, they knew way more than we did. What is it about that we want to credit those people in our past? And you know what? They weren't any different than we are.
Are people at a great distance, someone 1,000 miles away in a desert knows more than we do?
Is that, yes, yeah. Yes, let me go up to the Himalayas and climb up there and see the wisdom. And then all at once, I say, I'm searching for the most powerful person I can talk to spiritually. And they're like, well, there's this guy living in your hometown named David Budd. Have you talked to him?
Talk to Lars, he will tell you what's going on. Let's just start with this to bring people further up to speed.
Yeah.
Why the debate now about Castaneda? Was he full of prunes or was he the real thing? And you know, once again, we're admitting that question may, on a certain level of reality, be sort of irrelevant. But here's where the problems came in. He was an obscure, a graduate student in anthropology, grinding through old texts, putting a lot of time in with the library, and sometime at least out in the field meeting Native Americans as he wandered around. He impressed his anthropology professors enough, Or perhaps they wanted to impress the world out there that they were hip and with it and exploring new dimensions themselves.
Could be.
His work was the basis of a doctorate, and he was awarded a doctorate in anthropology by the University of California, Los Angeles. Later, over time, as more and more scholars looked at this and journalists looked at this, they said, well, now, wait a minute. There was no peyote use by the Yaqui Indians.
Absolutely.
In Sonora. The Huichol in another part of Mexico, yeah, it's a different story. Maybe to give this guy the benefit of the doubt, he was both changing the name of his great seer and also even changing the name of the group that he was looking at, the ethnic group, although that's pretty unusual.
The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
To protect the innocent kind of thing. But as serious people looked at this, they had more and more doubts. I mean, we are sitting here on the northern part of the Sonoran Desert as we speak to you in southern Arizona. And we can tell you that if you go down into Yaqui territory where we have all been in Sonora in the middle of the summer at 120 degrees, and he says this elderly sorcerer was kind of hopping around from bush to bush like a little sprite, to put it in blunt terms, we all say, bull crap.
We're
not feeling it. We're not seeing it.
We're not seeing it at all.
And we kind of get the feeling that we find it easier to believe the stories that later surfaced when someone went deep into Huichol territory and found the person who was maybe a likely model for this Don Matus character. And he had passed, but his widow said, yeah, oh, Castaneda, Carlos, yeah, I remember that guy. I remember that guy. No, he wasn't a serious spiritualist. He didn't have the discipline. He didn't, fasting, hiking in the desert. No, that wasn't him. He would hang around and ask a few questions, and he would wander back on down the road. No, he wasn't a serious apprentice to anybody or anything, is essentially what she said to the researchers who came later. I mean, he was challenged, Carlos Castaneda was, to produce his field notes. He said, well, darn, you know, that flood that came through my building a few years ago, darndest thing, all my notes, my field notes are gone. And I took such good, copious notes.
Ooh.
So it wasn't any one thing or any two things or three or four or five things, but over time, people started to say, well, you know, I think maybe he was a novelist with a rich, fertile imagination and some real gifts, but he didn't study with these people and spend all that time in Mexico that he said he did. And if he did, he didn't find people who had wisdom, and if they did, they didn't transmit it through any notes that we can find. Or
they certainly didn't share it with him.
They didn't share it with him. They didn't take him seriously. That was the consensus that developed later on. We have a novelist on our hands who presented himself as having gone to places and given us a clear notes from spiritual leaders. So that's what people call bullshit on.
Oh, yeah. And I agree with him. But then on the other hand... He changed my life. I don't think if I hadn't have read those books, I wouldn't have gone and done some of the things. I wouldn't have the courage or just the mindset to go and do some of these amazing things that I've got to do in my life. Just because I had the courage from just to say, hey, let me think outside the box. Let me do this. If he could do it, so can I.
Tell me you didn't take a little child that you were having discipline problems with and walk along with him until you got your thug to jump out from behind a bush and beat the crap out of him. Tell me that wasn't one of the things.
Well, according to the court order, I can't tell you that.
All right.
No, I didn't take everything literally. And again, the older I got, the more I could kind of get my bullshit filter in. You see, oh, that's a metaphor. He really didn't mean this. You know, this is a giant metaphor.
Yeah, I think approaching this with some maturity, because there are spiritual messages or perceptual messages outside of Western mainstream that are probably very useful. I don't know if we can convey this through the microphone, but we are a couple of guys, I think, who are very open to some alternative ways of looking at things. Would that
absolutely
be open?
That's a very good way to say it.
And not just our experience in the 60s, where it's rumored that at that time there were lots of hallucinogens sitting around and people took trips and experienced separate realities. Nothing that, of course, I would have ever had any part of.
Well,
you neither, right, Lars?
Oh,
absolutely,
yeah,
not.
Right.
No. But, I mean, we have experienced various kinds of body work, the disciplines that go way beyond Swedish massage and way beyond acupuncture. that gets you in touch with the mind-body connection.
Like the cranial sacral that some of these people do and things like that.
So much work, and we are in a community where they specialize in that kind of work, which is mind-body spirituality connection.
Sure.
And I think we are believers in the fact that the mind-body connection and is profound, and the Western reality, linear reality may be limited.
Absolutely.
And yet at the same time, I find myself a castaneda skeptic, and I guess it's because I've read too many stories through history about snake oil salesmen and the ways they work, and they seem to find your sweet spot, and they play right to it.
I think that had I not been 16, 17, 18 years old when I read that, had I read it maybe in my 30s or 40s, I would have been a little more quick to call bullshit on some of that stuff.
Our age, our experience makes a difference. If you look at what a good snake oil salesman is, it's not just a guy with a good pitch, but it's a guy who reads his audience and a guy who says, you know, here in Lizard Lick, Illinois, in this year where there's been 10 years of drought, they want to hear about rain.
Mm-hmm.
They want to hear about rich crops. They want to hear about things that soothe the particular ailments they've been having. And they want to hear about an end to corruption because that's what their local politicians have been doing. And I've got a couple of fixes that will fix all those things and make them feel like they're better people all in one big breath. How does this relate to Castaneda? I'm just saying that he came along at a time when a sort of a ebullient generation, but a lost generation, was worrying about getting shot to bits in Vietnam, was looking at corruption and explanations from the Pentagon about this or that linear projection of military power or this problem or arguments about federal budgets. And people are always looking naturally for a more expansive way to see the world. And he offered that on a lot of levels that seemed to say, if you follow this path, your problems go away and your mind will expand and you can do interesting drugs as a way to get there. Such a deal. What a package.
Yeah.
What a package.
Yeah.
I'll buy that.
But also, too, I think you're right. He came at the perfect storm because there was turmoil. It was confusion. We wanted to all be anarchists. We all wanted to do something completely different. It justified the fact that we were doing hallucinogenics or drugs. Or it's like, you know, my parents would never understand this. And you know what? Because they're not as sophisticated as I am. I'm reading all this stuff and learning about all these things outside of our little bubble here.
Think of the lyrics of the songs of the time. Paranoia strikes deep into our hearts, it will creep, and all that. You go back to that music if you want
right.
to dial up the classics of the 60s, the 70s. Bob Dylan, you know, spoke to a generation talking about the times they are changing. There was this sense that let's look for something better. Let's look for something that expands our minds and hearts and pulls us out of the old nonsense here.
Well, he was a voice that we all wanted, and he was a voice that spoke to many, many of us.
And it may have been accident, or it may have been very...
calculated?
Very calculated, I guess is the word I was going to use. But he spoke with an anthropologist's precision, and yet made it a little more interesting. Now, I sort of wonder, at what point did he realize... I'm a fair anthropologist, you know, a garden variety anthropologist. There's a million like me who end up teaching classes for a barely living wage in some little campus somewhere.
Sure.
But I'm a brilliant novelist. And maybe he realized that after someone said, take your doctoral thesis, and but they'll allow you to have the copyright, the university will, and put it out there as a paperback. And when it starts to sell millions of copies, who doesn't get a little full of himself?
Sure.
Or alternatively, who doesn't say, well, this is an important spiritual message, and I'm getting it out there. I mean, who am I to say that he was a charlatan? But it certainly fits a pattern that you see over and over and over again.
Yeah, but I'm not so sure that he started out as one. I think he may have become one. Your audience kind of helps you become that, because when somebody comes up to you all the time and goes, wow, you saved my life. Well, you, because if he heard me talk about how he changed my perspective on life or my directions in where I wanted to go and what I wanted to be, that's pretty fulfilling if you actually just changed one person. But he changed thousands.
Well, millions.
Millions.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're feeling the love from a group of people you speak for tonight, and yet you could be booked on any college campus and fill the hall anywhere he was that big a ticket in the throughout the 60s, early 70s. And it takes a lot of whatever spiritual wisdom he says he has to stand down from that kind of adulation. He did enjoy it for a while, or he certainly enjoyed the money and the book sale. It just seemed a little too perfect in the end. In the end, he was offering that you can fly above the world as like the crow flies, free of all worldly concerns. Here I am soaring and I'm free. You look down on all this, and as you study this discipline more and more, finally you'll become a pure, sweet, sweet and pure beam of light and just sort of go off into the cosmos purely that way. Such a deal. Wouldn't we all like to have?
Oh, that's great, yeah. Yeah. Well, the best part of it is, you know, you can promise that. It's a lot like some of the religions. They all promise these things. You don't have to deliver, because usually your deliverance is on your death. So it's like, okay, well, we got that going for us.
I mean, if you read his books and you go back and read the two or three original books which really got his fame going, let's say for the moment that they're sincere, but isn't it quite a coincidence that anything that would act as a check on whether he was really talking to a special seer and whether he was really bringing us fresh insights, he talks to Don Matus and he says, well, I'm going to bring back a tape recorder and a camera and capture a lot of this. He says, oh, no, that doesn't work. No, that can't
right.
happen. Well, why not? Well, it can't be spoken of again. Do you mind if I take some notes here? Well, you could write on that little notebook. I don't suppose that bothers me too much. Now, is this really what happened, or are we setting up a future in which he explains, well, I was never allowed to take any pictures, and I was never allowed to record his voice, so that's not available. And I did take a lot of notes, although I guess most of them were lost in that flood. But trust me, this all really happened on the dates that I have in my book. So the books sound very authentic on July 7th, 1970,
right.
This happened or that happened or the other. But then you try to pin down Castaneda on what really did happen or how he can prove it. And he just says, well, we're all a beam of light. And so, you know, what do you make of that? And that says more about us in the end than it does about him. Charlatans are a dime a dozen. But what does that say about all of us? Should we say, I don't really care about his background, but he did something for me? Or should we be so interested in the facts?
Well, that's what makes me sad, is because I'm very factual. And I realize he was just totally full of it. And appreciate what he did. But I don't like him because of how he did it. So, but again, that's the toss-up. That's the incongruency in my displeasure with this mystery.
I mean, can you share any examples of things that you either explored or life situations that you handled differently after reading his thoughts about a separate reality and a finer spirituality?
It was one of those things that just gave you courage to do things. It's like, okay, this is... Because my reality was very limited, very, you know, I was going to be like an accountant. You know, I was going to probably live and die in this little town that I lived in. Well, I started reading him, like, oh, there's other things out there. This gives me the courage to seek out things. And I was going to be an artist, and somebody said, well, you can't make any money being an artist. And I'm like, really? Well, let's just see. Well, I've been an art director and an artist for 43 years. So, you know, I don't think I would have even attempted any of that stuff had I not been enlightened or, you know, spiritually challenged and enlightened and awakened by him.
And so the reaction I have is that's a lot more important than whether he was telling a semi-fictional story or an entirely true anthropological story. In a way, I think that's much more important to touch lives.
Well, in a way, if you look at him like an Aesop, the sour grapes or whatever, then that's kind of the way I do it. That's how I deal with it.
Fables.
My disappointment. Yeah, he's telling me allegories and fables and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, spiritual is as spiritual does, in one sense, is how I think of this stuff.
Yeah.
And got a lot of respect for people that you meet. And Lars and I are talking to you from a community which, per square person, has a lot of people who really are seeking some spiritual, different kind of spiritual reality.
Right.
A lot of people who are out of the ordinary are seeking something deeper and something better. And you hear someone, she went to study with the Swami this or the Swami that, or went to study this discipline or that. And sometimes I see some of these folks handle some very difficult situations with a lot less frustration than I would. And I realize they are getting something from these disciplines. They are, through their Buddhism or Taoism or studying with this seer or with this Swami, they are imbibing a kind of discipline that is good, that is useful to them, you know.
Right.
In other words, it's where the rubber meets the road. If you become a better person, isn't that what matters? If you become a more comfortable person.
That's the dilemma, and that's why this is a mystery to me.
So let's come back another time, having introduced this to folks, and maybe bring in a couple of people who might have known Castaneda or were very much involved in his movement, and explore this a little further. You know, we're talking about a couple of different things. Was his journey real, something because he did earn an anthropology doctorate from it, and then there's a lot of debate about that now, or was it fictional? And then the bigger question, I mean, does it really matter? What was his spirituality? What was his gift to the generation of the 60s and 70s and folks like that who live on and we're supposedly role models to the next bunch of kids coming up? So
I hope so.
So let's revisit this before too long.
Sounds good to me.
Thanks, Lars.
Thanks, David.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.